the National Archives podcast series, Ugandan Asians in Britain, Journeys Across Three Continents to Find a Home, presented by Karim Hussein. This podcast was recorded on the 14th of November 2012 as part of Diversity Week at the National Archives, Kew.
Before starting, I should just like to say, for the benefit of everyone, that everything in this talk, all the documents and facts you'll see and hear about, I have found using freely available resources here at the National Archives. Given that fact, it's worth noting a very fundamental truth about this place. The records and the history they contain, their value is determined by how much people use them. So if Diversity Week is about anything, then it's about encouraging the broadest possible base of users. In other words, everyone here today and everyone listening at home. Also, for the purposes of the duration of this talk, I'll be using the terms Indian and Asian interchangeably, because in Uganda, under British rule, the popular cultural use of the words created an overlap in relative meaning. This doesn't mean, as I hope to explain, that they are the same, or that all Asians in Uganda were in fact Indians, because they weren't. So with that little caveat, let's begin. My talk today, which marks the 40th anniversary of expelled Ugandan Asians coming to Britain, is split into three sections, the aim of which is to track the journey of a group of people from Uganda in East Africa to Britain. In the beginning of that journey, I'll talk about economic trends which first drove Indian migration to Uganda, and how the nature of that migration affected their relationship with the native African population. Afterwards, in the second leg of the journey, I'll talk about Idi Amin's expulsion in 1972, exploring some of the different experiences and reactions to it. Here I want to try and describe the process by which people are turned into refugees. For the third part, as the Asians make their way to Britain, I'll take the focus away from Uganda and look at events here. In this part, I want to try and describe the new environment the Asians found themselves in and how the unique circumstances helped and hindered their resettlement, before ending with a final thought on the impact of Ugandan Asians in Britain today. So the story of how Ugandan Asians ended up in Britain starts first with the question, why were there so many continental Asians in continental Africa? Well, one of the most important occurrences in the history of East Africa, and certainly best known in the region, was the construction of the Uganda-Kenya Railway, spanning a distance of over 1,000 kilometres from Uganda's capital Kampala to Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa. It was a colossal undertaking, driven by the Imperial British East Africa Company. The idea behind its construction was to reinforce colonial claims on the region by developing management of its resources through trade. It's a familiar story of colonial expansion, and the project was sound in theory. It was also befitting the ambitions of an empire confidently buoyed by the knowledge that the sun could never set on it. However, from its outset, in 1896, the project was plagued with financial and material shortages, not least of which included the availability of a sufficiently skilled labour force for the task. Crucially, the workforce used to construct the railway were indentured Indian labourers shipped into East Africa. As a result of this government-sponsored migration, a popular myth took shape amongst Africans that the majority of Asians in Uganda were descended from these labourers, or coolies as they were known. But contrary to that belief, by the 1920s, only a small proportion could trace their ancestry to these indentured labourers. In fact, of the 32,000 labourers used to build the railway, under 7,000 stayed to settle, and most of them weren't even Indians, at least not as we know them, but Muslims from the Punjab, annexed into the colonial boundaries of British India. The Asians who came to Uganda as indentured labourers give us an idea of the kind of stereotypes that were created about them, but they don't explain who the Asian migrants of the 20th century were. For that, we need to briefly take an even further step back through time. Indentured labourers from British India were not the earliest or even the largest instance of migration which led to Asian settlement in East Africa. For centuries, merchant sailors from northwestern India and the Arab Peninsula traded along the African coastline. Protected by desert and distance, countries like Uganda were naturally shielded against European interference, allowing the trading relationship to flourish. Ivory, skins, and slaves were exchanged for ironware, cloth, beads, and spices. So prolific and powerful had these traders been allowed to become that they were able to establish Zanzibar as a semi-autonomous state under Asian control. Like the Europeans, then, the first pattern of Asian migration to East Africa were as successful colonizers. When the Europeans first arrived to the region in the 16th century, They began systematically over the period of 400 years, dismantling old Asian monopolies and taking over trade routes, sometimes by force, mostly by simple commerce and coercion. The process, which was initiated first by the Portuguese, followed by the French and Germans, led eventually to the British colonization of East Africa in the early 19th century. An important factor in how the British wrested control over trade from the Asians is rooted in the regulations they imposed, in particular their ban on the slave trade. The long-established Asian traders and rulers like those in Zanzibar, who depended on a freer way of doing business, lost their economic control on the region until they were forced to accept the status of a British protectorate. Having dislodged one group of Asian settlers, the British instigated a new and second wave of Asian migration. These new Asians had little in common with the indentured labourers who came to East Africa escaping overpopulation, famine and starvation back home. Instead, they were mainly merchant traders who seized the opportunities that arose from the trading vacuum created by the overzealous British takeover of the region. The East Africa Company actively encouraged this new pattern of migration, hoping that it would develop the region's stunted agricultural economy. The East Africa Company's very charter emphasizes the need for such an exchange, stating that the possessions of the East African coastline would be advantageous to the commercial and other interests of our subjects in the Indian Ocean, who would otherwise be compelled to reside and trade under the government or protection of alien powers. Adding to this royal charter, Lord Salisbury, the Secretary of State to India, in 1875, personally recommended Indian emigration to East Africa for the purposes of settlement and colonization. He openly suggested that the imperial designs of the British and humanitarian purposes would be served by sending these intelligent and industrious people to an area climatically well suited to receive them. From the perspective of the new Asian migrants, however, a very different kind of opportunity was espied than the one envisioned by Lord Salisbury. Few of the Indian merchants had any interest in becoming tenant farmers for British landowners in East Africa. After all, they were forbidden ownership of any of the land. But under early British administration, they found themselves free to operate a thriving unregulated trade, effectively restoring the exchange relationship which the earliest Asians had monopolized and the British had so effectively taken apart. Unbeknown to the British, the second wave of Asian traders even managed to continue the slave trade. But the manner of their activities and the nature of their relationship, which lacked the sense of legitimacy that earlier Asians had garnered, earned the new Asian migrants a reputation for exploitation, which reinforced racial prejudices in the native African mindset. Eventually, when the British caught on to what was going on, new restrictions to access were put into place, but the pattern of a self-sustaining flow of migration had already taken root. This pattern is best understood by a closer examination of the migrating people. The majority of Indian merchants who settled in Uganda in the early 20th century came from very specific places such as Gujarat, Kathiawar, and Kutch. The volume of migration from these areas was driven by earlier pioneers who had already established themselves in Uganda from the same region. So the idea of moving there was encouraged by friends and familial ties. Successive Asian migrants through this period were increasingly independent, having paid their own way and gone possessed of skills, knowledge, and means to a place where there was a high demand for them. As this community of settled Asians grew, the once merchant traders formed into the archetypal middle class. In the 50 years between the construction of the railways, when the number of Asians in East Africa could be counted in the tens of thousands, by the end of the Second World War, it was thought to have risen dramatically to over 320,000. It was these entrepreneurial Asians who set the standard not only for the Asians, for the type of Asians who would follow, but also for a new generation of Asians born in East Africa. The society which emerged in Uganda out of this pattern of migration leading into the second half of the 20th century was a very stratified one. At the top sat the Europeans who maintained a firm ownership of the land. In the social strata beneath them, the Asians were used to generate a market-based economy as professional workers, traders, manufacturers, and increasingly as wholesalers. At the very bottom were the native Africans. Forbidden trading licenses or deemed incapable of entering into professional occupations, they could only play the role of manual labourers, and so became the working poor. In many ways, the genius of the colonial experiment in Africa is how the Europeans managed to create a class system that had become synonymous with race. There was virtually no mixing between the three layers in this uneven coexistence, allowing stereotypes to become embedded into the very fabric of their social contracts with one another. The lives of people born into this social order, or societal order, also became predetermined from one generation to the next. So what changed? What disrupted this social order? Well, the simple answer is the post-war decline of empire after two successive world wars. The visible withdrawal of white colonial presence from this extremely stratified society resulted in an increased level of upward social mobility for the layers below. The gradual growth of an African middle class through the 1930s and 40s that rivaled the Asians brought the two communities into direct competition and conflict. A survey of retail traders in Uganda, conducted by the British in 1952, for instance, revealed that the balance, which up till the end of the Second World War had been in favour of the Asians, had in fact shifted, making African traders more numerous. Earlier in 1950, this competition burst into open attacks on Asian shopkeepers, and in 1951, it manifested in a year-long African boycott of Asian shops. Whilst Asians and African traders fought for the shop stalls, another group of Asians also found their lot increase in the wake of British withdrawal. A steadily growing number of Asian wholesalers appeared at the time to remain largely immune from street-level competition, allowing them to assume a near 80% control of foreign trade licenses through the 1950s. The second great destabilizing agent, also attributable to the decline of empire, was the politicization of ethnic minorities in East Africa. When British India was granted independence, and more importantly, partitioned in 1947, the immediate effect was that Indians, along with other minorities from Pakistan and Bangladesh, demanded separate representation, transposing onto Asian life in Africa the religious and sectarian divisions that existed in the Asian subcontinent. In the past, under colonial rule, the British encouraged these divisions, or at least did nothing to stop them, because it made the Asian community as a whole a less effective political force and more conducive to colonial systems of indoctrination and social stratification. However, in the post-partition years, the politicization of different Asian communities in Uganda brought the issue of their citizenship and their place in Uganda's future into the forefront of debate, a debate that was already saturated with racial prejudice and now also inflamed by resentment against the lack of African independence. When independence was finally achieved in Uganda on the 9th of October 1962, as former colonials themselves, the Asians generally supported it. But there was always a tentative reserve to that support, given the underlying tensions between the communities. The first real indication of what was to come occurred in 1966, when the socialist leader Apollo Milton Obote assumed the Ugandan presidency in a bloody coup and began his crackdown on Asian monopolies and wholesale trade licenses. He also nationalized major industries run by prominent Indian families such as the Mehdi and Madhvanis and restricted the residential status of what he called non-citizens in Uganda. Claiming the measures were part of a wider movement of Africanization, where native populations were exercising their newly acquired political authority to reclaim the continent from colonial influence and exploitation, Obote effectively halted the flow of Asian migration into Uganda, but he could do little about the Asians already there. Such measures, alongside widespread indications of corruption and acts of suppression, meant that when Obote was himself overthrown by Idi Amin in 1971, it was welcomed both by Africans and Asians alike. But whatever hopes either community in Uganda had for Amin's presidency, they were short-lived. In October 1971, within 6 months of Amin taking office, he ordered a census of Asian residents in the country. By December, as Amin's character became apparent, not least through his self-proclaimed title, His Excellency, President for Life, Doctor, El Haji, King of all the beasts on the earth and fishes in the sea, and liberator from the British Empire of all Africa and Uganda in particular. That's not just a sentence, by the way. That was his official title. When all this came to light, real fears began to emerge about what this new leader might do. A series of announcements, which then followed, made it clear where Amin was heading. The first bombshell came on the 7th of December, 1971, when he called a conference of Asian community representatives in which he bitterly denounced the Asians for their lack of support, their exploitation, and their social exclusivity. Then, 6 months later, when the dust from that bombshell settled, he dropped another. On the 30th of July 1972, Amin declared that our industry and commerce are being manned by foreigners. It's unclear exactly when Amin decided to expel the Asians. Reading into the mind of a man like Amin is no reasoned task. What we do know is that 4 days later, on the 4th of August 1972, during an address to the Airborne Regiment in Toro, he ordered the expulsion of all Asians from Uganda, declaring that they were sabotaging the economy of the country. After he repeated the order during a press conference the same day, news of the announcement spread throughout Uganda and through the rest of the world. Three questions arose repeatedly in the immediate aftermath. 1. was the president serious? 2, if he were, which Asians were affected by the expulsion order? He can't possibly mean everybody. And 3, what sort of deadline would consequently be imposed on their departure? The Asians didn't have to wait long for the answers to the first and third questions, at least. On the 8th of August, Amin signed the decree in which the expulsion order was made official. The deadline for the Asians to leave was set in 90 days' time for the 7th of November 1972. There was now no going back from the mass exodus that would have to take place. But even then, there was hope, because the answer to the second question remained uncertain. The problem posed by the question of who exactly would be expelled found Amin unprepared and dithering in the face of the legal implications of his decree. A blanket statement for all Asians to leave may have seemed clear to a man like the general, but on closer examination, the varying legal status of each individual, together with the great need in Uganda for its middle-class professionals and the threat of international sanctions, meant that he had to reconsider. The next morning, after his initial announcement, Amin amended the decree, saying only all Asians holding British, Indian, Pakistani and Bangladeshi passports must leave. Okay, so not everybody would have to go. A few days after that, he added all non-citizen Asians, even those holding Kenyan and Tanzanian passports must leave too. Again, not good, but still not everybody. Realising that this would leave the country virtually unworkable, Amin again changed his position and announced that certain parts of the professional classes would be exempt. For thousands of Asians on the receiving end of this tirade of decrees, the emotional experience was like being on a roller coaster. In describing his own experience of the time, the biographer and social historian Mahmoud Mandani gives us a particularly interesting account of the effect these decrees had on community relations. It was incredible how this last decree drove a wedge between non-professionals and the professionals in the Asian community. All of a sudden, one's identity changed from that of being an Asian to being a professional Asian. A part of the community prepared to celebrate, another to leave. But then before the celebrations were over, yet another announcement came. This time, there will be no exceptions. And finally, all Asians, citizens or no, must leave. In the days that followed, Mandani goes on to describe how a depression set in amongst the Asians. It didn't matter that a few days later, after mounting international pressure, Amin withdrew his call for all Asians to be expelled, allowing Ugandan citizen Asians to stay. Because all it meant that Amin was starting to learn the importance of political and legal camouflage. He would simply change tactic and find another way to force the Asians out. One such tactic was to require all citizen Asians to queue up at their local immigration office to verify their citizenship claim. Each person would have to produce passports, birth and marriage certificates for themselves and their parents in order to retain the right to stay. All this at a time when if you were born in East Africa, the chances were you would never have been issued with any of them. For those who could meet this absurd standard of evidence required, some other arbitrary discrepancy might be found to allow the officials to question a document's authenticity, rendering it invalid. So began the administrative process of summarily invalidating citizenships and creating stateless refugees in their thousands. The decrees didn't stop there either. Every day, Mamdani tells us, saw the announcement of another formality to be undergone, a new form to be filled or a new law to be observed. For instance, the decree to limit the wealth that the expelled Asian community could take with them to £50 came the day after the official expulsion order was signed. Faced with the Asian community's desperate attempts to salvage what assets they could in the 3 months they had, Amin's government cracked down by freezing banking transactions and raising the level of searches that the Asians were subject to before leaving. In fact, however much the Asians tried to expatriate their wealth from Uganda, in the end, Amin was always going to win, because he forced them to leave more than they could take. He did this by introducing enough disorder and uncertainty into their lives, making it impossible for them to plan their escape. Hence the endless decrees continually changing the circumstances of escape. The harassment and disorder which Amin generated to shake loose the accumulated wealth of the Asians and take possession of it had another more deadly consequence too. Many in Amin's relatively undisciplined army took the chaos as license and opportunity for acts of individual greed. There are no official figures I can find on the scale of the looting, robbing, raiding, murder and rape that went on in those 3 months. But no expelled Asian I have spoken to left without some horrific story to tell. Perhaps the best way to gauge the horror which Amin had unleashed is found in how he had to restrain his own soldiers. Fearing international military intervention, Amin himself provided buses under military guard to take the Asians to their points of departure. He was also forced to pass numerous decrees for looters to be shot on sight, and the assets of those Asians leaving to be strictly secured for later legal redistribution. On that somber note, as the Asians prepared to make their perilous escape, I want to shift the point from which we perceive the expulsion and start looking at the situation from Britain. On hearing of the expulsion order, the British government's initial reaction was tantamount to, was it something we said? Ironically, on the same day as Amin's announcement, the Foreign Office agreed to review its system of immigration control over allowing East African colonial citizens into Britain. Amin's government had long been pressuring the UK to allow a faster rate of emigration to those Asians who wanted to leave voluntarily, but Britain was reluctant to allow so many people in so quickly. 2 days after Amin made the expulsion order, the Under Secretary of State, David Lane, remained firm in his Conservative election promise, declaring he would not allow any further large-scale permanent immigration into Britain. However, when it became clear that Britain would have to consider the very special humanitarian circumstances of the Ugandan Asians outside the existing rules of immigration control, the Home Secretary, Robert Carr, found himself countermanding his own deputy on the floor of Parliament when he announced that the government was beginning intense diplomatic activity to try and ward off this threatened, inhumane treatment of many thousands of Asians, the majority of whom are United Kingdom passport holders. Under Carr's instruction, the Secretary for Environment, Sir Geoffrey Rippon, was dispatched to meet with Amin and try and persuade him to reconsider the order. When they met in Kampala on the 16th of August, records of the Foreign Office show that whilst the discussion was cordial, it was also tense. Within the surviving notes of their conversations, Rippon reminded the General of the very real possibility of the withdrawal of aid to Uganda should the expulsion take place. Amin, however, remained intransigent, saying he thought that even 3 months was too long for the Asians to leave. The sooner Uganda got rid of them, the better. On returning to London the next day, as Rippon reported that he was unable to change the President's mind, more news of Amin's reaction to the British request emerged, and the question was no longer if, but when and how the British government should prepare to receive the Asians. According to the census carried out in the previous year, there were approximately 80,000 Asians in Uganda at the time. Of them, 23,242 were, for all intents and purposes, British colonial citizens holding UK passports little different to those carried by people in the UK. Alongside these UK passport holders, there were citizens of other nationalities, but there would also be a mass of approximately 30,000 Asians who, in the course of the last two generations, decided to become Ugandans. Their passports now invalidated, they became entirely stateless. This group were the most vulnerable refugees and the most difficult to place because they had no claim to go anywhere but would still need to be accommodated somewhere. Working with the United Nations in an effort to figure out what could be done for such a large group of displaced people, the British government began a canvass of other sympathetic governments to try and find a solution. Most of the Commonwealth countries expressed their outrage and regret but were reluctant to make any firm commitment. The government of Canada, for instance, was the first to come forward to offer accommodation, but only to qualified Asians which its economy needed. Others, such as the Australian Minister for Immigration, Jim Forbes, maintained that the government should not accede to the British request for cooperation in accepting the Ugandan expellees. Applications by Asians in Uganda will continue to be considered on their individual merits in accordance with our non-European immigration policies. These policies reflect the firm and unshakable determination of the government to maintain a homogeneous society in Australia, meaning in essence, such persons with Anglo-Saxon physical features who possess the necessary skills to allow integration. As the dust of frantic negotiations settled in those 90 days, a report based on an estimate by the Foreign Office shows that in the end, aside from Britain, India took in 8,000 Asians, Canada took 5,000, Pakistan and America took just over 1,000 each, and all other countries involved took numbers only in the hundreds. Amongst African nations too, Britain made numerous representations to gauge what help could be found, but reaction there gave even more cause for concern. Uganda's neighbours, Tanzania, Kenya and Zambia, each had its own sizeable Asian minority with similar cultural histories. In Tanzania, President Nyerere vocally condemned Amin's blatant racism, but as a socialist harbouring the deposed Ugandan president Obote and his rebel army, the border between the two countries was a war zone to be avoided than a choice of destination to send tens of thousands of refugees. In Zambia, President Kunda also expressed disgust at Amin's actions, but couldn't refrain from adding that the present situation in Uganda was a legacy of British imperialism and therefore British responsibility. Kenya's president had no such sympathetic words. Following Amin's decree, the borders between the two countries were closed, and the Home Affairs Minister declared Amin's decree a timely and wise decision to give the Ugandans the right to control their economy. Following these reactions, Britain immediately raised the matter with the United Nations to ensure future expulsions by independent nations do not fall into the sole hands of British responsibility. Under these international circumstances, on the 19th of September 1972, the first immigrant special bound for Britain left Uganda's Entebbe Airport with 193 Asians on board. Its departure signalled the beginning of a major airlift which would bring nearly 28,000 Ugandan Asians to Britain by November 7th. At first, the processing of so many Asians through the Ugandan Immigration Office on one side and then through the British High Commission on the other was slow and frustrating. The British administrators in Kampala neither had the staff or the ability to process refugees on such a large scale so quickly. But as Amin's military began checking buildings for non-citizens, the threat of violence and detention increased and procedure and protocol were set aside. By mid-October, the job was all about getting people on planes and out of Uganda. Arriving in Britain, it's hard to imagine a more different place than the one they had just left. Most came with only what they could carry, their lives uprooted and destroyed, whole families and communities dispersed based on their varying legal statuses as British, foreign, colonial, or just stateless refugees. Fearful, traumatized, and apprehensive about the British reception, they landed on windswept airstrips on an island surrounded by the cold and harsh North Atlantic Ocean. Meanwhile, British authorities, in preparation to receive and manage the transition of Asians, established the Ugandan Asian Resettlement Board amidst great fanfare to demonstrate that the crisis was well in hand. Now, normally, immigration authorities would expect new arrivals to find their own homes and generally secure their own future. The Ugandan Resettlement Board, however, was pitched as an entirely new approach. Given executive powers to organise the resettlement process, the board was to act as a liaison centre through which appropriate government departments, voluntary organisations and local authorities could channel assistance and maximise their effective use of resources. Sir Charles Cunningham, former permanent undersecretary at the Home Office, explained the board's purpose in three main points: to form reception teams, to find temporary accommodation, and to persuade the new arrivals to go to areas not under pressure in housing, education, and social services. It was clearly a multi-pronged approach, designed to reassure everyone that nothing was being left to chance. However, almost from its very inception, the board was besieged by criticism. The fundamental problem was that it made decisions based on past immigration patterns without complete consideration of the unique circumstances of these new arrivals. The board were convinced that if the resettlement centres were needed at all, it would be only for 1, maybe 2 days at most. Officials assumed the expelled Asians would be relatively self-sufficient, that they would have family or know people in Britain who could take them in and help them settle. This assumption was reinforced by reports on the composition of the Asians, indicating them to be a people capable of landing on their own 2 feet. What the reports did not show and could not explain is that previous Asian migrants tended to arrive in a staggered process, where one person, normally the head of the household, would go in advance of the whole family to establish a home and find steady work before being followed by the rest. These expelled Asians were afforded no such process of acclimatization. Many were also separated from the heads of their household during the chaos of expulsion. Women and children in this situation who had never worked or could not speak English were extremely difficult to place and hard to help. Of the 193 passengers who arrived on the first flight, 101 had no place to go on arrival and were transported to the resettlement centre in Stradishul. Given that more than half the Asians would require prolonged and substantial help to resettle, it fast became clear that the transit camps would need to serve for much longer than envisaged or were prepared for. As a result, when the 16 disused and often remote military camps set up to house them began to fill up, they started increasingly to feel like detention centres. Here again, Mahmoud Mandani, through the written account of his own experience, can give us an understanding of what went wrong. Allocated to the Kensington Resettlement Centre, he tells us that the rate of people finding jobs and homes was slow. Out of the 4,000 people who had arrived in Britain by the 1st of October, 3,000 were still in transit camps, with tens of thousands still waiting to come. Part of the problem was that there evolved a sort of master-servant formal relationship between the camp administrators and the communities that lived in them. Staff and residents were kept separate, much the same way as in Uganda, with the colour stratification of society. Under such circumstances, the way the administrators gained familiarity with the residents was by collecting information about them. But what meant familiarity to the administrator spelt control to the resident. Control over access to resources, opportunities, all in the exclusive hands of the administrators, breeding resentment. The camp was run like a total institution, much like a prison or insane asylum, with the distinction between private and public life obliterated. It was at the Kensington camp, and not in Amin's Uganda, which, Mamdani tells us, he first experienced what it would be like to live in a totalitarian society. The point I'm trying to make, using Mamdani's words here, is not to criticise the government, but to show that the longer the refugees stayed in the camps, the more time was spent managing it as a permanent holding facility, leaving less and less time to settle. The conviction that the camp would need to accommodate more people for longer periods of time thus became almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. For those who did make it out, the support provided by the resettlement board also fell often well short of the mark. Too eager to make room for new arrivals, the board was criticised for providing unsuitable housing or not effectively protecting them from exploitations by unscrupulous landlords and moneylenders. When some Asians did almost inevitably run into trouble and tried to return to the resettlement camps for further help and advice, neither were forthcoming, as Sir Charles Cunningham himself had to admit in an interview with The Times, saying, "There is no specific action that the board could take to alleviate hardships being encountered by the refugees once outside the camps. It would be contrary to the welfare of the Ugandan Asians to return to the artificial atmosphere of the resettlement centres." For the Asians, many felt that the board wasn't so much helping them resettle as much as getting rid of them. Part of the problem was that British administrators, like the British public at large, could not fully understand why the Asians were there at all, and why they didn't go to the countries of their forefathers. Unfortunately for the expelled Asians, the crisis occurred at a time which could hardly be described as uneventful. In addition to long-standing immigration difficulties, a combination of impending European common market entry, persistent problems with Northern Ireland, shortages of housing, mounting inflation, a long and unpleasant dock strike, together with continued rising unemployment, meant that the mood of the country was not conducive to a ready acceptance of many thousand non-white refugees. This intolerance spilled out on the 25th of August 1972, when 400 demonstrators turned out in London to protest the invasion of Britain by Ugandan Asians. The leading spokesman in Britain for white supremacy at the time, Enoch Powell, also spoke to the highly critical popular reaction, saying, "Those rightly shocked at the prospect of 50,000 Asians from Uganda being added to our population have no idea that about 100,000 are added through immigration and natural increase to the coloured population of this country every year." In the face of this perceived trend, why, many normal British people were asking, were we responsible, while the rest of the world remains aloof? The answer can be found in the legal frameworks created to control immigration in the wake of the declining empire, wherein the advantages of imperial power were diminishing, but the obligations seemed to remain. No people in the old empire depended more on British assistance than the East African Asians. When they first went to East Africa, at the height of empire, and assumed their place in British colonial society, their role in that society was protected by their place in colonial rule, and they held what they believed was the ultimate guarantee against future difficulties, British citizenship. Now that certainty was under threat. Almost ironically, though, the Ugandan-Asian crisis came during an extended period of net out-migration. More people were actually leaving Britain than coming. This could have been a good sign, but for the fact that the out-migration was comprised mainly of whites leaving for old dominions such as Canada, South Africa, New Zealand and Australia, whilst those arriving were mainly from new dominions of the Indian subcontinent, the West Indies and East Africa. The extent of coloured immigration was alarming Britain and contributed substantially to the uneasiness concerning the arrival of Asians from Uganda. This uneasiness prompted a whole series of ineffectual laws up to 1972's, going back as far as 1931, when Britain first legally recognised the independence of Commonwealth countries, allowing freedom of movement to protect trade at a time when immigration into Britain was not large and almost entirely white. Then in 1948, after Indian independence, the British Nationality Act redefined the status of British subjects and Commonwealth citizens, affording non-white colonials the ability to secure equal rights and privileges all over the Commonwealth. This was a hugely altruistic move, which utterly changed and exploded the patterns of migration around the world. Such was the effect of this act that many of the white, old white dominions wanted no part of it, whilst Britain's doors flew wide open. When it soon became clear that the sudden influx was unmanageable, the new Commonwealth Immigration Act of 1962 was an attempt to introduce some measure of control. But the act was ineffectual, because with East African independence at hand, British ministers such as Duncan Sandys, concerned over the fate of white settlers, provided exemptions and escape clauses allowing colonials to choose to retain British citizenship. Most Asians did precisely that. Ultimately, the British government was forced to accept that the 1962 Act wasn't working, which prompted the 1968 Commonwealth and Immigration Act. This law was more stringent in its control elements, introducing both a quota system and application process before entry to the UK was permitted. The quota cap figure of 1,500 for the whole of East Africa, however, wasn't nearly enough, and within 2 years, the system had a backlog of over 2,000 Ugandan cases alone. The 68 Act, which had proved just as unworkable as its predecessor, was then first amended in 1971 by increasing the cap, and then later, in the same year, replaced entirely with the 1971 Immigration Act. This new act significantly changed the common law right to entry to a statutory right to abode, which was defined as applying to those persons with sufficient connection to the United Kingdom to qualify them as patrials. In effect, it did what the 62 Act intended but failed to do. It permitted entry to old white dominion colonials who could trace their lineage to Britain, but restricted access to coloured people from Africa and Asia. The result was a temporary slowing in the rate of Asian entry into Britain. But as we saw in Africa in the first few decades of the 20th century, it could not be stopped, because a pattern of migration had already taken root. So when Amin declared his expulsion order, again the British found themselves as King Canute trying to turn back the tide. This is because despite the difficult timing and public uneasiness, there was little actual doubt that the expelled Asians would have the right to enter Britain. As the crisis unfolded, the legal status in both domestic and international law was closely scrutinised by Sir Peter Rawlinson, the Attorney General, who explained why. A state is under duty to accept on its territory those of its nationals who have nowhere else to go, said Attorney General Rawlinson. Thus, if an Asian citizen of the United Kingdom and colonies is expelled from Uganda and is not accepted for settlement elsewhere, we can be required to accept him in any state where he then is. Leaving no doubt about their arrival, the British government and people would just have to find a way through the crisis. Into this mix, the Ugandan Asians, one must accept, played their part in making the process of transition difficult. Initial plans by the Resettlement Board to disperse them sufficiently to limit their visible impact were continually undermined when the new arrivals showed a tendency to congregate around existing concentrations of Asians in Britain. The instinct of the Asians is, of course, perfectly understandable. For many people in the camps, a few bad experiences of racism was enough to make them want to find safety and security amongst the peoples of familiar origins. So just as it was in Uganda, the 350,000-strong South Asian population already in Britain provided support structures that made their transition of migration easier. But for the government and public reaction, it further inflamed growing resentments. In Leicester, where about 10,000 Ugandan refugees ended up, despite government attempts to dissuade Asians from going there, the Home Secretary was forced to conduct emergency meetings with the City Council to help them cope with the mounting cost of resettlement. In those early days, when resentments were at their highest, it was actually Amin, now 5,000 miles away, who had the greatest effect on changing the tide of British public opinion when he compared himself to Hitler. In a telegram sent to the United Nations, Amin said in his characteristic rambling and broken English, "Germany is the right place where when Hitler was Prime Minister and Supreme Commander. This is because Hitler and all the German people knew that the Israelis are not people who are working in the interests of the people of the world. And that is why they burnt over 6 million Jews alive with gas on the soil of Germany. The world should remember that the Palestinians, with the assistance of Germany, made the operation possible in the Olympic Village." The original telegram, which was sent only a few weeks following the awful Munich Olympic massacre, prompted global outrage, branding Amin as an ignorant and cruel despot. In Britain, the story set public sympathy firmly on the side of the expelled Asians. Thousands of volunteers came to their aid, boosting official confidence in handling the crisis. As numbers grew, over 20 national voluntary organisations formed a joint coordinating committee. Alongside the committee, the British Council of Churches, representing over 60 groups, provided everything from language classes to legal representation. At one of the remotest resettlement camps, set up at an abandoned army facility in the Welsh coast, a journalist writing for Nova magazine described the experience of the place. Bounded by wet hills on three sides and the sea on the fourth, it was like a film set of some dismal offlag. The camp had only the first week of October in which to emerge from its dormancy. Huts were dried out, heaters installed, mains reconnected, and the canteen refurbished. Within 3 weeks of opening its doors, this camp alone hosted 800 refugees. The work to provide basic shelter, food, and accommodation was done almost entirely by volunteers. The Women's Royal Volunteer Service provided tea and clothing for new arrivals, whilst community service volunteers arranged beds and mattresses. The whole affair had a wartime spirit to it. In London, even the normally conservative press got involved on the side of the Asians. The Daily Express, for example, attempted to assuage British fears of job competition by suggesting that the introduction of a relatively small coloured workforce would benefit the economy by providing willing labour for jobs the British workers would not do, especially in industrial regions such as the Midlands. Even the highly unionised working class poor, who comprised most of the 900,000 unemployed in Britain and felt they had the most to lose from the Ugandan Asians coming to take their jobs, came round to oppose the exploitation of another defenceless and now equally working class group of people. Despite the many problems, then, which can reasonably be expected when such a large programme of relocation is conducted under such unique circumstances, I think it's fair to say that the whole resettlement exercise was achieved with relative success. According to the figures of the Resettlement Board, within 4 months into the emergency programme, over 10,000 refugees had been relocated, and within 2 years, the last of the refugees was settled outside the transit camps in some form or another. The process was rarely perfect, but remarkable too for the fact that the majority of those people involved were in it out of a desire to help, and those motivations were shared across race, class, and other cultural differences. The refugees themselves were also a people greatly celebrated for their spirit. Starting from scratch, the Asians overcame the many obstacles of forced migration and resettlement to set up new lives, businesses, and communities, which helped change the face of Britain and what it meant to be British. An extraordinary fact I came across in the course of my research for this talk suggested that within the next decade, thanks to the Ugandan Asians, Leicester is predicted to become the first major city in Britain to have a majority non-white population. Finally, to end this talk, I'd like to tell you the story of the Lahani family, which for me stood out more than any other. Mr. Lahani was born in Uganda in 1940, his father before him having arrived there from India in 1934. By 1972, Mr. Lahani was an affluent banker and together with his brothers owned a successful transport business. When the expulsion order came, as UK passport holders with relatives already in Britain, they came here. Arriving in Britain, Mr. Lahani was amongst many to be separated from his family. With the financial support of British relatives, his wife and children were quickly housed, but Mr. Lahani's own paperwork took a bit longer to process, during which time he was placed in the camp in Stradishaw. Fortunately, this separation was only temporary, lasting just under a month. Once out of the camp, something incredible happened. Another refugee, a Jewish man by the name of Peter Black, who had escaped Nazi Germany in the 1930s, offered Mr. Lahani a job at his factory in Yorkshire. On top of this, he provided free accommodation for a year and employed Mrs. Lahani too. After 9 years, the Lahanis had saved enough money to move to London and start a business of their own. I came across this story months ago in the Independent newspaper. It was written by Mr. Lahani's daughter, Nina, who is now a national journalist of some renown. For me, the story of the Lahani family sums up the humanity of the government's decision to take in the refugees despite obvious self-interest. It's also a demonstration of the Ugandan Asians' self-worth and the worth of those volunteers and relatives who took the time to help them. In her article, Nina Lahani wrote, "Naturally, I've often wondered what my life might have been like had Amin not been a deranged despot, and I now can't stop thinking about how different I might have been. My mum's take on these musings is, don't think about it too much. Everything happens for a reason. If any part of that reason is the multicultural, multiracial Britain we have today, then it's an outcome I, for one, cannot regret."
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, all rights reserved.